Tina Gerhardt, welcome to KABU.
Great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation, Bill.
Tina Gerhardt has a distinguished career teaching and writing and cultural studies, much on film and critical theory. And then along came looming environmental threats to human life. She kept teaching, but turned to environmental journalism, researching and writing, publishing in many U.S. magazines, including The Nation and Sierra Club magazine. For the last several weeks, Tina Gerhardt's been in Glasgow, Scotland, observing the 26th United Nations Conference of the Parties. The first conference, it was in Rio de Janeiro. It had the lofty aim of uniting the world and planning what to do when it became clear that humanity, mostly in the developed industrialist countries, that we in the rich world, although must be said, most of us in the U.S. live hand to mouth and most precarious, but that, quote, rich countries were on a path to destroying the ecosystems upon which life depends. Now it's Conference 26, almost 30 years later, and in every one of those 29 years, greenhouse gas, near every one of those 29 years, greenhouse gas emissions have continued to rise. Greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere have precipitously risen. And climate scientists now estimate that we have 8 years to take drastic action or risk calamity. Tina Gerhardt, before this 26th meeting of the parties, over 200 countries, in fact, the stakes were high in the conference. Several national leaders, including Joe Biden, called this, in quotes, the last best chance to save the planet. So, Tina, did our leaders and elites, did they finally turn the corner? Do we now have a binding agreement with enforcement and a doable plan for stopping global warming? What happened in Glasgow?
Yes, thanks for the invitation to give your listeners a bit more of a report back from COP26 in Glasgow. I think one of the things that's really important to know as setting a stage for, you know, context basically for what I'm going to say that follows is that this was intended by COP26 President Alok Sharma to be the most inclusive COP ever. And it wound up, it's been called the whitest and wealthiest UN climate negotiation. What I mean by that is that what's been referred to as vaccine apartheid, visa issues, and then just the prohibitive costs. I guess, you know, Airbnb and hotels were gouging people up to like $1,500 a night for hotel rooms. The combination of those factors prevented a lot of people, predominantly from the global south, from attending. And that really manifested in terms of who was on the ground, meaning activists, delegates, journalists. I think there was like a third of Pacific Islands had people in attendance. It really hit Latin American countries hard and also Africa. So I think that's really important for context. But in terms of the takeaway, you know, I wrote in The Nation, the results were decidedly mixed. I think in terms of some of the upsides coming out of COP26, fossil fuels were mentioned for the first time, which might surprise listeners because that's the source of the climate crisis that we're in, and yet they don't get mentioned. They have been alluded to in the Kyoto Protocol. They were alluded to, and there was one other reference in a draft text, but they've never been in. So that's great, but the downside there is that even if they were referred to, it was really a watered-down reference to them. So initially the call was for a phase-out of coal and of fossil fuel subsidies, and then that ended up getting watered down twice, actually. One of the watered-downs that people might have heard about in the main news that's already reported on this is the phase-out. In a moment of high drama at the very end, went to a phase-down. India, as they thought they were going to pass the Glasgow Climate Pact, as it came to be known, they spoke up and requested that phase out be changed to phase down. Now, that language of phase down is also in the U.S.-China agreement that was announced last week and kind of a beacon of hope. But, you know, I have questions about whether it's a beacon of hope if that language was also put forward, and China put it forward, if that was also there, right? It was supposed to be this moment, you know, the two nations working together where things move forward. But then India does this move where they call for a phase down instead of a phase out. The same language is used by China, and the U.S. went along with it. And they're all among the high coal-producing and consuming nations. So that was one downside in terms of the fossil fuels. The other thing that had a lot of attention was funding, so money. And I think for your listeners, the big picture here is this push for money really indicates two things. How intensely the global countries in the global south are already suffering and have been for the past decade. This isn't a new thing that just arrived on their coastlines, you know, like Hurricane Ida or the fires we've experienced last year. They've been experiencing these kinds of intense events for at least a decade. So that's the important framing for the funding. So they have two pieces of good news. They keep pushing for funding for what gets called adaptation. There's a lot of UN speak and a lot of acronyms at COP26. But what adaptation really means is basically that you need monies for things that will help you to respond to the impacts of climate change. So those could be things like seawalls, which I'm not a big fan of. They could also be things like managed retreat or moving infrastructure or, you know, people inland. That's managed retreat, but also moving infrastructure inland. That wasn't getting enough monies, and they got more money from the UN this year via the COP26. The other kind of money that they're asking for is through a mechanism, again, this is UN language, called loss and damage. So loss and damage refers to intense impacts of climate change that were unpredictable and that have now created situations where you have loss and damage, for example, a hurricane, or if you don't want like something that's so quick, like a lightning flash, slower climate change impacts like drought or like sea level rise also count. Now, this one is really, really tricky. They didn't get money for it. They didn't even get what was called a facility, which would have been the thing through which they could have gotten money. They didn't even get that into the Glasgow Climate Pact. And the reason is this has also been referred to as climate reparations. And it really opens the door for forcing the global north to acknowledge their historical emissions, the historical inequities of those emissions, and to have to pay up for having created the situation that we're in. Now, the U.S. and the EU is vehemently opposed. They think this will expose them to future liability. And so instead of creating this thing that I mentioned earlier, which in UN speak was called a facility, they changed that word to dialogue. And islanders, you know, people from the global south, islands in the Pacific, members of the G77, which includes a lot of sub-Saharan African countries, they were just fuming. They were like, we don't need more dialogue and conversation, more blah, 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 as Greta Thunberg has put it. We actually need the money. We need action. So I think those are the three big takeaways. There's one other thing I'll add in terms of emissions. People came to the table, countries came to the table this year with emissions that were below the targets that are needed that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has put forward. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and this is in the Glasgow Climate Pact, which is great, they say that you need 45% of greenhouse gas emissions reductions based on 2010 levels by 2030, crucial decade for action is this decade, in order to keep global warming to 1.5. Islands always say 1.5 to stay alive. So of the G20 nations, which are responsible for 80% of emissions, only the EU has weighed in with a commitment that actually meets that. It actually exceeds that they offered 55%. So all the other nations now have to come back next year that don't meet that target. They all have to come. It's like bad school children. If they haven't done their homework, they all have to come back next year with cuts and pledges that actually meet that target. And that's a good thing because previously out of the Paris Agreement, they had to come back every 5 years. But because, like I said, this decade by 2030 is the one for action, the realization is really that they have to report back every year. And that's a huge change. I mean, one of the things coming out of COP26 that I realized is it's, you know, as everyone can tell, it's a really unwieldy, complicated, slow, cumbersome, slow-moving animal, COP26. One of the reasons is because it works by consensus models, which not everyone is familiar with, but for your listeners who are or who have participated in leftist forums that use consensus, they'll know exactly why that would make it cumbersome. But it's, you know, in terms of temporal scale, the climate crisis is moving really quickly. It needs action this decade. And the UN is just maybe not the right vehicle because it only meets once a year because it requires consensus, which is typically good, but it's too slow.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Hour here on KABU 90.7 FM Portland, talking to Tina Gerhardt, who teaches now mostly about the environment and who attended the Glasgow International Conference on dealing with climate change. We've been discussing how this 26th annual meeting, they started in 1972, it had some promising initiatives, and at least including fossil fuel phase down, which is in fact what the corporations talk about, because they want it to be really slow so there's no stranded assets and so they can adjust and they don't have to change anything about the way they operate or their profit model, that is to maintain business as usual, which would include a phase down. There were a number of other provisions. Tina, in an article you wrote, The Problem with Net Zero, you wrote about the plans, that they were basically inadequate and many were completely phony. That is absurd. But it seems to me that just demanding a plan every year, if they're allowed to just make absurd claims, Microsoft, in fact, made an announcement that they were going to become net zero in a short amount of time through carbon sequestration. Well, that technology is completely unproven. Where they've done it, it's extremely expensive, and they don't know what to do with all of this carbon dioxide. They want to pump it into caves and stuff. It's hard to believe that Microsoft would do that, but I think most of the corporations, the whole of capitalism, just doesn't want to deal. If you want to have a livable planet, they have to completely reconstruct themselves, and I mean completely. Why don't you talk about the plans and why net zero is such a terrible idea, but it seems to be it's still prevalent.
So I wrote about net zero for Sierra, but I was also asked, at the invitation of my editors, I was also asked to write an article earlier this year by the editors of The Progressive. And the issue with net zero, and your listeners who want to dig into this a little bit more deeply, I would really recommend that they go to check out work by Corporate Accountability, which is an organization that has really been focusing on net zero and some of the fallacies in terms of its arguments. So the problems with net zero, the main problem for me is it kicks the can down the road, right? You hear at COP or in general, like when climate is mentioned with regard to net zero, you will typically hear net zero by 2050 or later. And like I said a number of times, this decade is the one for action. And action doesn't mean pie-in-the-sky pledges, it doesn't mean pie-in-the-sky promises. It actually means policy in place and implemented, and that policy leading to action on the ground. Because policy in place can also be, you know, with this bill that just passed in the U.S. yesterday on infrastructure, a lot of the talk right away was, well, how long is it going to take to roll it out, right? So really action and concrete signs of emissions reductions this decade is what's needed, not pie-in-the-sky ideas. So net zero, I think, is really a delay tactic in order to kick the can down the road, in order to not have to take action. That's on the part of governments. It's also on the part of corporations. And some of the problems that Corporate Accountability did study together with the Sierra Club, and one of the things that they found is that some of what is put forward to lead to net zero by 2050 is fiction. You know, they have this article, it's called The Big Con, How Polluters Are Advancing a Net Zero Climate Agenda to Delay, Deceive, and Deny. And, you know, they found in that report the corporations are spending lavishly to lobby and undermine progress towards real solutions and real zero. But it's a lot of it is just based on fictions. There's also human rights concerns involved with net zero and relations, again, between global north and global south. And what I mean by that is offsets are part of net zero, which has been bandied about for ages and is hugely problematic. So forests in the global south get used, you know, a corporation or a nation says, okay, well, Indonesia, if you give us part of your forest, we won't chop it down, and then we'll get to say that we've reduced our emissions. Now, that might sound fine, but in terms of human rights violations, some of these kinds of agreements might lead to land grabs. So the global north is grabbing land from the south. It might lead to the movements of people off of those lands, which is where the human rights violations come in. But most of all, for me, is the concern that it's just too far down the road. We need concrete action now, and even policies, you know, there's a lag between policies and implementation. And that brings me back to one of your points in the opening. We are really at a moment where we're seeing the limits of this current economic system. I mean, it's being pushed up against in terms of the funding demands I mentioned at the outset. I call this, you know, fancy math, like any fancy math tricks. Math tricks aren't going to fool science, right? It just needs to be action. So we're really seeing the limits of this economic model, and time will tell, but I think all of the actions that work not only to address the climate crisis, but really to retool our economies in a way that ensures equity, be it within our communities, you know, domestically, sub-states of domestically, you know, at state level, local level, community level, or even global equity between nations. I mean, that's really what this moment demands. And it also really demands that we rethink our relationship to nature, not only as a resource, you know, which viewing it as a carbon sink basically is viewing it as a resource to solve our problems, but really viewing it as something that we need to live in harmony with very differently than we have.
Tina Gearhart, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation, truly, Bill. I'm so grateful that you're doing this work.
I'm grateful you're doing your work. Keep up the good work. Hi, folks. This is Bill Resnick here for the Old Mill Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, talking to Tina Gearhart. She left a scholarly life to teach research and write about the destruction of the ecosystems upon which life depends. Tina Gearhart observed at the Glasgow UN conference that just ended. The conferences started in 1992. Since then, there's been 26 of them. They've accomplished very little, basically kicking the can down the road. At the 26th conference that just ended, over 200 countries submitted estimates of their greenhouse gas emissions and also submitted their plan for eliminating those emissions. Unfortunately, as you just heard, nearly every country undercounted their emissions, fabricating the numbers. And their plans were full of technological solutions that even if they work, they are not proven. And even if they were proven to work, they presented great dangers. That was discussed in part one of the interview. Tina and I will be doing part two next week, discussing what the nations of the world must do to avert the looming catastrophe. A catastrophe, again, that could well result in human extinction. Physics is relentless. Keep doing what we have been doing, temperatures will soar to make the planet uninhabitable. Next week, Tina and I will discuss what could be done to save the planet.